Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Space science gets microscopic. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. A new NASA mission launching from Kennedy Space Center will soon study some of Earth's tiniest creatures from space. The PACE spacecraft will study particles in Earth's atmosphere and tiny microscopic organisms in its oceans to monitor things like plankton and algae blooms that can be harmful to our ecosystem. We'll speak with NASA's Andrew Sayer about studying Earth's seas from above. Then, what happens if an astronaut gets sick in space or has an infection? Staph bacteria are being studied on the International Space Station to see what dangers might show up in the space environment. We'll speak with University of Florida's Kelly Rice about her experiment that's currently in orbit. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? At the base of the oceanic food chain are plankton, and plankton are crucial for marine life to survive and thrive. However, plankton can also be a danger to the environment and to humans. Plankton cause toxic algae blooms that harm the water and the animals near it. And with more and more algal blooms appearing in the ocean, NASA created the PACE satellite to study these blooms faster and more efficiently in space. The satellite is launching this week from NASA's Kennedy Space Center. Here to talk more about PACE and how it will help our planet is NASA's Andrew Sayer, a senior scientist on the PACE mission. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Well, Andrew, this satellite is going to be kind of looking at the ocean and atmosphere globally. Tell us a bit about why you are so excited about this mission.
PACE is an acronym. NASA loves acronym, and it stands for plankton, aerosol, cloud, and then ocean ecosystem. So, you know, with the word ocean there, it's a bit contrived. So that's two atmospheric things, aerosols, that's these small particles like dust or smoke, the clouds. And then the P and the E is about the ocean. So that's plankton. So that's these kind of tiny plants which live in water. They're the base of the food web, and they can be beneficial. You know, they as a base of the food web, you know, they're literally food for other plankton, for fish, and ultimately for us. And they can be harmful. Sometimes you can get a harmful algal bloom, then it's not safe to go in the water. And where PACE is a unique contribution is going to be is right now we've got a pretty good handle on how much plankton there is, how much aerosol there is in the atmosphere. We don't have such a good handle on is exactly what species of plankton and exactly what types of aerosol. So PACE is going to give us this extra level of detail, this extra level of specificity, which will make all of our downstream applications and all of our understanding that much finer.
So that's fascinating. How are you able to see that from space, though? I mean, plankton, they're tiny little buggers, aren't they?
They're really tiny. You know, you've got to use a microscope to see them. You take a little sample of water and you put them on a slide, right? But it's kind of like the hairs on your head. If you've got just one hair, you know, it's real hard to see. But if you look at someone, if we're doing audio, you can't see. I'm a pretty hairy guy. You can see I've got a lot of hair. So it's just kind of like we can't see the individual cells of plankton from space, but all we can see are the blooms, these large scale features. And they can be tens or hundreds of kilometers wide. So we're up there in space because space is the only way that you can really do this. It's the only way you can see the whole planet on the scales we need to. You can't be monitoring from ships everywhere. We're looking through the atmosphere, and about 5 to 10% of the light that we see reflected comes from the ocean. So we're really picking out these very, very subtle signals, these subtle variations in the color and the brightness of the ocean. And that's what tells us how much plankton is there and what type.
So it's all about color, and I can see, obviously this is radio, I can see on your t-shirt there you've got the color spectrum there and picture of the satellite. So that makes sense that this is really looking at the different changes in color in the ocean. That's a pretty fascinating way to do this, right?
Yeah, I mean, we think of naively as, you know, if you give the box of crayons to a kid and you say paint the ocean, probably they're going to pick a blue and just, you know, shade it in. And this is like going from a box of 8 or so crayons with the satellites we've had now to one where we've got like 200 and something colors. This instrument on my t-shirt, again, is called the OCI, the Ocean Color Instrument. It's the main sensor on PACE. and it's going to measure reflected sunlight in more than 200 colors. So instead of just kind of shading in blue, we'll be able to get all these nuances, different shades of blue and green. And even out of the range of the light that we can see, we're going to go all the way into the ultraviolet, and then all the way into what we call the shortwave infrared. So kind of beyond the limits of human vision, we can't see it, but the plankton and the atmosphere, they have signals of these colors.
Let's talk a bit about why this is so important. You mentioned it a bit before, but our listeners, especially our local listeners, will know about algal blooms, right? We're always watching algal blooms in like the Indian River here, and it's very detrimental to our local ecosystems here. Is that something that it's important to monitor across the globe, and how will PACE kind of aid in those efforts of monitoring these harmful algal blooms?
So right now, a lot of monitoring is kind of done physically, like someone goes out and samples a body of water on a regular cadence, right? And that's incredibly important. But like I say, you know, you can't have people monitoring everywhere all the time, which is why we want to do it from space. And the big advance of PACE is going to be able to see remotely exactly what species are there. And right, absolutely down here in Florida, you've got red tides, you've got various different blooms. This is not like a local phenomenon, it's global. And so where we're going to be able to contribute is getting the data needed for these alerts on a global scale, you know, and really pretty fast and pretty regularly. And we really haven't had that up to now to such a degree.
How is PACE going to do that, to get you fast and regular updates? Will it be kind of orbiting the Earth in a way where it can take images every X amount of hours or X amount of days that you're able to analyze?
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the satellites people are familiar with for weather, they're in something called a geostationary orbit, which is really high up, and it kind of images a fixed part of the world fairly regularly. So PACE is what we call in a low Earth sun-synchronous polar orbit, right? And that means it orbits around the Earth, the Earth rotates beneath it, and it gets to see the whole world over the course of one day, and it maintains like a roughly constant local time of observation. So that means if you look up in the sky about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, PACE is up there somewhere monitoring. It's kind of passively recording this data, right? So it's going from the South Pole to the North Pole during the daytime. As it flies over these ground stations, it beams the data back down to Earth. Then that data gets processed through these software algorithms. That's kind of my job, develop some of these techniques we use to turn the raw measurements into what we want to actually know, you know, what's in the sky, what's in the ocean. And that's available free to download by anyone on the planet, and it typically goes out within a few hours of it being kind of downloaded from the satellite, so people can use this stuff almost immediately, which is real great for all these time-sensitive purposes.
And once a day, right? I mean, that's a very frequent snapshot of what's happening, which can really allow you to see kind of trends and things, pardon the pun, but things blooming, you know, danger blooming in our oceans, right?
Exactly. So a lot of the lifetimes of some of these aerosol species in the atmosphere and these plankton blooms in the ocean, they can be pretty short. So if you only had like a revisit once a week, you know, you might miss it. You might, you know, never know it was there. So like I say, we're going to see once a day. And in fact, at high latitudes, the kind of the views of the orbits overlap. So sometimes we'll get repeat views of the same area within about 100 minutes of each other. So an even more rapid cadence.
We've been talking a lot about plankton and oceans, but the A in PACE is aerosol, right? You're going to actually be looking at what's happening in the atmosphere, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And that's my kind of area of expertise primarily. So when we say aerosol, you know, you might think of like underarm deodorant or hairspray or like a rattle can of paint, and that's all aerosol. But, you know, I don't know if you, your listeners, you know, you ever go for like an early morning jog, or maybe you take a walk along the beach with your loved one at night, and you take a deep breath, you inhale, you smell salt, right? So that salt's an aerosol. Maybe you're you grill in the summer, maybe you have a fire in your backyard in the winter, you know, your clothes smell the next day. Why? That's the smoke. That's an aerosol too. So it's things like that. It's also desert dust. It's volcanic ash. It's smog and other urban pollution. Is all of these things which are in our atmosphere, they come from a different, all these different sources around the globe. They live different lifetimes. They move in different ways. And when they're up in the sky, they age, they change, they merge with another. So what we're going to do is see exactly what's there and how high it is in the atmosphere as well. And that's important because when these aerosols are what we call nose level, they can have all these human health impacts. And air quality is an increasingly, severe issue in certain parts of the world, you know, both within the US and internationally. And so just like you can't monitor the whole ocean at once, you can't monitor the whole world at once, except from space. So that's one of the big contributions we're going to try and make.
I have to just say that I love the term nose level, and I'm going to try to work that into my daily life. it's a great measurement.
That's what we care about. That's where we breathe in, right? So whatever's there, that's going inside us, yeah.
Yeah, nose level. That makes sense. Andrew, you mentioned that this data is going to be available rather quickly to anybody. But how do you actually see this data being used to make decisions or kind of warn people about potential hazards? You know, what will be the end product of this data that PACE will be collecting?
So that's a great question. And on the NASA side, our main job is like building the satellite and then getting it up there and getting it, sending the data down. And then, like I say, turning the raw measurements into what people want to know, like the atmospheric quantities, the ocean quantities. And we partner with a whole bunch of institutions all over the country and all over the world. We have this thing we call an early adopter program, where prior to launch, we've been helping people spin up their applications, their alert systems on kind of simulated data, on proxy data. So the idea is that when data is being returned, which will hopefully be within a couple of months from now, from space to the ground, they'll be able to hit the ground running and kind of, whatever they need to do, whatever they want to do, they'll be ready. We'll be here to support them. And I think it's been a real big success having this early adopter program, because it's allowed us to kind of decrease the time lag from when it goes up to when it's actually, useful on making a real impact in people's lives.
Finally, Andrew, let's talk about the launch and kind of the first days and weeks of the vehicle in orbit. Tell us a bit about how it's getting to space, and then what has to happen when it is in space before you can start taking these measurements and getting the data back to us.
Okay, so the launch is going to be Tuesday morning, so 1:33 a.m. And it's going to be weather dependent whether it goes up today. Obviously, putting stuff in space is a tricky business. So there's lots of criteria about weather conditions. So if the weather doesn't cooperate, we'll try again the next night and then the next night and so on. So all things being well, crossing fingers, everybody here at Kennedy is crossing our fingers right now. It's going to go up. It's going to reach its low Earth orbit of about 700 kilometers really pretty quickly. And then over the next few days and weeks, we're going to switch on all of the systems, make sure everything's communicating properly, and then we're going to let it kind of acclimate, come to the right temperature of space, and finally switch all the instruments on. And that happens over a period of a few weeks. So we're hoping that within maybe 1 month or so, we'll have what's called first light, which is when we start kind of getting the first pictures back and kind of our routine operations. And so that's basically, what it's going to be doing then for hopefully a decade or more in space. That's going to happen within 60 days of launch. So by the end of March, we should have kind of be, fully 100% up and running.
We've been speaking with Andrew Sayer. He's a senior scientist on the PACE mission. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm really happy to share this with you. It's been like, it's like Christmas is tomorrow. I can't wait.
Still to come, why one scientist launched staph bacteria into space.
Anything, again, we can learn about how it responds to stress could hopefully help us for this pathogen on Earth here.
Staph in space, and how an orbital experiment can help protect us here on Earth from its deadly infection. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Staph is a bacterium that can lead to a variety of infections in the human body. The most common staph infection is with the skin, and around 30% of people carry staph just in their noses. And a scientist at the University of Florida just sent staph bacteria, the cause of staph infections, to space for science.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition, engine full power, and liftoff. Go Cygnus, go Falcon.
Because the bacteria is so common and has the potential to be deadly if an infection moves deeper into the body, scientists are testing how the bacteria reacts in space. The goal? Keep astronauts safe and help fight infections here on Earth. Here to talk more about her experiment and why she sent staff to the International Space Station in the first place is Kelly Rice, an associate professor at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Kelly, you and your team sent a staph infection to space. That sounds like an absolutely terrible idea, but you're doing it for science, right? Tell us a bit about the motivation behind this.
Sure. So, just to recap, it's actually not an infection we're sending. We're actually sending the bacteria that have the potential for causing infection. And we send the bacteria because we're very interested in addressing strategies that help astronaut health during long-term space flight missions, especially as we're looking forward to returning to the moon and eventually to Mars and sending manned crews there. So what we just launched on NG-20 was samples of bacteria that are in a closed system, so that it's been thoroughly tested and vetted to ensure that astronauts themselves are not actually going to be exposed to those bacteria at all during the experiment. So it's very safe. And the reason we're sending these to space, to the low Earth orbit, I should say it, in the International Space Station, is a previous study that was conducted by NASA, and we were involved in analyzing the data for that study. It turns out that staph, when you send it to the ISS, induces expression of genes that are involved in communication, and it impacts the virulence, and so potentially. So those are highly increased in space flight during in low Earth orbit. And so we're following up on that observation in this current experiment.
Gotcha. All right. Thanks for that clarification. Well, before we get into the implications of this study, can you just give me a quick overview of this bacteria? What is it? What is this little bugger, and why are you so interested in studying it?
So staph is a bacteria that's colonized on 20 to 30% of us. So it can be in our nose, it can be found on our skin and other body sites. And in that capacity, we call it a commensal. So it basically is relatively harmless in that context. It's just coming along for the ride. However, under certain conditions, if your immune system is out of whack, or if you experience physical trauma, so a cut on your skin, things like that, staph can go from being harmless to harmful if it gains access to your body in those ways. And so that's why during enclosed systems like the International Space Station, because some of us are colonized with staph, it can become predominant in those environments. And so we're very interested in studying the potential for it to be dangerous in those environments.
All right. Some of us are colonized with staph. That is absolutely terrifying, Kelly. Thanks for that. So let's talk about the implications for space. And I know you kind of got into this a bit before, but could it be a bad thing if this turns into an infection, as you describe it, in a closed environment like the International Space Station, right? Is that kind of the impetus of this study, is the protection of astronauts?
Yes. So there's a couple of levels. So, of course, ultimately, we're interested in preserving astronaut health on longer term missions. And so the things that we learn about how this bacteria responds to this environment in a closed system, in the ISS or low Earth orbit and beyond, we can hopefully use that knowledge to design strategies to prevent astronauts from getting sick in the first place. It also could potentially have benefit for life here back on Earth, because staph is a common cause of infections in hospitals, and it could actually be acquired in the community as well from person to person, some strains. We're not working with those, of course, in this particular context. So basically, on a more general level, though, NASA and scientists are very interested in how bacteria in general, not just staph, but other bacteria, also respond to the spaceflight environment, because we're going to be bringing our microbes, our bacteria with us when we go to space. So we want to better understand how all those bacteria behave. And so hopefully the insights we gain with staph could also be applied to others as well.
And it's not just the closed environment of the International Space Station, right? I've got to assume that the microgravity environment has an impact on the behavior and the growth of all sorts of little buggers, including what you're looking at, right? So tell me a bit about how microgravity may affect the growth of this bacteria.
So that's a really interesting question. So before we send bacteria on spaceflight missions, we often study their response to microgravity on the ground using models. So we call that simulated microgravity. So it's not the real thing, but it's the next best thing. And it's a more controllable system on the ground. And it different bacteria appear to respond differently to microgravity as a signal. And so that's why it's even more important to, we can't just make assumptions based on studying one kind of bacteria in the spaceflight environment or on the ground in simulations. It's important to study all kinds of different bacteria because they do not seem to have a one-size-fits-all response to that signal.
You know, that's really fascinating. I didn't know that. Is that why when you mentioned the communication of the bacteria, is that what you're talking about? Is how it actually communicates with one another? Microgravity affects all of that?
It could be a number of different things. Certainly, communication between the cells could be a part of it. It could be the different ways in which different bacteria grow, the kinds of bacterial food equivalent that they eat and how they process that. It could be their ability to respond to stress. It could be their ability to grow in communities of cells known as biofilms. So there's all kinds of different ways in which microgravity or simulated microgravity could affect those properties. And so, so that's a very active field in the space biology realm of investigation when it comes to microbes and the bacteria that we're interested in.
Well, that's really fascinating. Let's talk a bit about the experiment itself. You know, you said that it's a sealed experiment because this wouldn't be too good if it got out, right? So tell me a bit about the equipment that you sent up there and where this experiment is actually going to be taking place.
So the hardware, as they call it, that is being used is called a BRIC PDF view, and that stands for Biological Research in Canisters and Petri Dish Forming Units. So it's a bit of a jargon, scientific jargon there, but essentially it looks like a tiny shoebox, and basically it holds the bacterial samples, and there's a separate chamber for sterile media, the growth media for the bacteria. So we send the bacteria dried on these plates inside this closed system, and that's thoroughly safety tested and tested to make sure there's no leaks, both before the bacteria samples are integrated into the unit and afterwards. So there's a lot of checks and balances along the way. And basically, when it reaches the ISS, when the astronauts are ready to start the experiment, they have a tool they use to basically allow the media to enter the chamber that contains the bacteria. And then in response to that, the bacteria will start to grow. And all this happens inside. They don't actually have to touch anything. It's simply looks like a plunger tool, and they just actuate the experiment that way. And then after 2 days, the whole thing goes into a minus 80 degrees Celsius freezer. So it keeps things in stasis, basically. And then when it finally comes back down to Earth on a return flight, that's also kept frozen. And so it's basically like a snapshot of the bacteria frozen in time. And so once we get them back on Earth, here is when the real fun begins. I mean, this has been all fun, but the next phase of the fun begins, where we get to process the samples and study them in a number of different ways.
I've got to ask you, how cool is it to know that your experiment is in space, and the fact that you use the term "when it returns to Earth"? That's going to be it's going to be incredible that your science experiment is above our heads right now.
Absolutely, this has been. I grew up watching Star Trek, Star Wars, Buck Rogers reruns with my dad growing up in the late 70s, early 80s. And I've always been kind of a science nerd and a star space nerd. And this has just been a dream come true to be able to actually integrate this into my actual job and my work. So this is our lab's very first flight experiment. We've done some ground-based studies before with NASA funding, and this is our very first flight experiment. So super exciting to be able to use those phrases, like you said.
So what are some of the challenges involved in that? I mean, you mentioned that, you know, you've got to develop a canister or something that will encapsulate the experiment to make sure astronauts are safe, but also you're not there to actually run the experiment, right? I mean, what are the challenges that go into doing research like this, incredibly important research that comes with a host of challenges, I would imagine?
Absolutely. So the first thing is that I stand on the shoulders of giants. So this hardware has been used in several other similar studies, including one by a colleague that was in our department at the university. And so there have been several other missions using this exact hardware to grow bacteria on the ISS. And so in terms of developing new ways to do it, I didn't actually have to do that, because also we want to compare our results to those previous studies. So it's important to keep that consistent.
Yeah. What are the challenges of you not actually being there to do this study?
So the astronauts receive a very detailed protocol on what to do each step. And I'm not actually involved in communicating with them during the experiment itself, but the protocol is developed in collaboration with the scientists at NASA, myself, and again, some of the astronauts have done this experiment before because there have been previous flight missions using the same type of hardware. So fortunately, we try to make their job as easy as possible by, you know, fine-tuning the experimental design in a way that's amenable for them completing the work, because their time is very valuable. Obviously, they wear a lot of different hats in their role.
Kelly, pardon this question, but I have to ask because I, too, am a fan of science fiction. Should we be worried about bacteria from space coming back to Earth? And are there protections in place? It picked up any weird qualities after its time spent in orbit.
So I can only speak expertly on staff itself, and they have flown staff and brought it back, like I said, in the previous mission.
And nothing bad has happened at all, right?
No, they appear to have undergone transient changes in space, which could have the potential to make them more dangerous, but we don't actually, you know, we need to study that further. So that's why we're sending it back again. And then in terms of foreign bacteria, not of this world, coming back, that's a whole other arm of the NASA branch that focuses on that as a potential concern. And I can't really speak to that in an expert way.
Well, you have eased my concern, so thank you for that. And I'm glad someone, not just me, is thinking about it. So let's go back to the experiment. You mentioned briefly that this may have some impacts on terrestrial staph bacteria and the prevention of those infections. I mean, how do you see this research being used to help the people down here on Earth?
So anything we can learn about this bacteria's ability to respond to stress will be helpful, because even though it's not going to be encountering microgravity on Earth, being in a closed environment, a built environment like the space station, those environments also exist on Earth in different capacities, whether it be simulators for folks that are undergoing flight training, you know, cockpits, you know, of aircraft. I mean, there's closed environments. So a better understanding of how the bacteria responds to that will be helpful for sure. And basically just in a general, you know, anything, again, we can learn about how it responds to stress could hopefully help us thwart this pathogen on Earth here.
Kelly Rice is an associate professor at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That is going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, and now, or even on YouTube. And really, you can get this podcast wherever you get your other podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are we there yet? This is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marian Summerall, and our intern is Emily Ching. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.